Hey friends, Ayana here. It is a crisp new season, and we are so excited to bring you a brand new series, In the Company of Humpbacks. Over three episodes, we'll wander the waters off Alaska, exploring the lives, the thrums, and the migrations of humpback whales, with stories and insight from Fred Sharp, Rachel Mead, and Joe Olson. This series is full of sonic exploration, migration stories, and research discoveries. But it's also about something deeper, curiosity, wonder, and the relationships we build with the more-than-human world. Along the way, we move between science and story, the technical and the magical, between whale thrums and the questions we carry. This journey came to life thanks to the generosity and care of the Five Fingers Lighthouse. You can learn more about their work at forthewild.world. Thewild.world. Episode 2 is A Walk with Fred Sharp. In this conversation, I bring some of my own vulnerability, my mistrust of science, the fear that humans don't always know how to be in right relationship with the more than human world, and the lingering concern about extractive research. Fred meets these questions with grace, humor, and deep insight. Together, we explore the love of the wild, the drive that compels people to observe, study, and protect, and the challenge of staying present in these complicated waters. This episode is intimate, reflective, and at times a little uncomfortable, but it's also full of warmth and relational care and curiosity, the qualities that make meaningful conservation work possible.
What we have found in great abundance is evidence of absence. We know where we looked, we know what frequencies we've checked, and so far, it's just us, and it makes you really appreciate the animals that you do have on this earth. Signals get missed, and so keep looking, don't lose heart. This is great. You know, this island is really cool because it's, ships kept running into it. When it was the Klondike Gold Rush that, that's up in your area, isn't it? It's like, you Klondikeans.
Yeah.
And, so it was big. People found some precious metals in the ground. Human nature being what it is, everybody wandered in the action. So ships started sailing up here and they'd come around Cape Fanshawe, and this was a very problematic Five Fingers. It was realized that there needs to be a lighthouse on the southernmost of the islets for the gold seekers. And here we are. A century later, here we sit on the Thaiwan.
Well, I feel my heart breaking in the most overwhelming and pleasurable and soulful way standing here. The tidal colors and the sherbet colors of the sunset and the blues and the purples and the oranges, and I feel the tears in my eyes, and I'm so grateful to feel that. So take me back to the start.
It starts with my parents, who were, they were park rangers, you know, naturalist, forestry people, outdoor education, just growing up in the national parks as a kid, right? And just having this, like, unabiding desire to be out in wilderness and find fun stuff to do. And getting into botanical sciences. That's my main area of training, was birds and botanical sciences, right? Mm. But then coming up here and seeing the whales, it was like, holy cow, this is crazy. This place is beautiful. And back then there was so little, back then they were still considered critically endangered, and there was not much research done on them. So it just worked out to like, this is cool. I'm not doing anything for the rest of my life. That's what I love, still staying in the education aspects of it, because that really feeds you, right? yeah. just sharing with people and lecturing and writing. And you can see people who have seen a bubble net for the first time, right? Or got, you know, and it's just like, it's life changing, right? And I just love to change my life. And it's like, people just don't always have the option of like, leave all things and follow me type stuff, right? Me as in Megapatera, the genus of the whale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not familiar. Explain that. Break that down for me.
Yeah, I love that. In terms of like, didn't Jesus say that? Leave all things and follow me?
Oh, okay. Biblical. It's been a while since I opened a Bible.
Yeah, and I think actually it started when I was living in Michigan. My first 6 years were in the university. My parents were at the university there. And we would go to a field camp in the Upper Peninsula every summer and crossing the Mackinac Bridge and seeing the those blue horizons. Mm. It was freshwater. And last time I checked, there wasn't cetaceans in the Great Lakes. But just having that blue marble kind of feel, kind of watery world type, sweet Gaia. Just like, I think I got hooked back then to like marine stuff.
Okay, so I'm seeing a bit of the shape of your childhood and the inspiration. And then where do whales come in?
I think it's more just like, rather than it being any type of like career choice or just getting up here and experience them, right? And smell their breath and hear all their crazy sounds and the dynamic social structure and their tool using behaviors and their division of labor and past specialization. It's like there's just so much going on, right? And there's so much of it is like so much is kind of eerily people like in that they have these food co-ops and these bubble net teams, right? And the way they interact with each other and move around, it's like they have the incident command system.
And are we hearing a thrum or what?
We're hearing distant breathing. Oh, that's gorgeous. Yeah, this is typically the thrumming hour. Right now where it feels like the feeding has been pretty good to the south. So we've had a lot of animals drift down. Joe said when they came in, they were sort of hanging out at, it's like they were crossing over to Big Creek. But there's enough animals, and as the wind dies, we should start to hear some thrums rolling in from the due west over by Brothers Island, that aggregation that we saw out there. But yeah, it's cool. The thrums are like, they're one of those strange signals that the further the whale gets away, it's almost easier to detect it. Because when you it's delivered by at close range, it's the raspberry, the whale's kind of, it's like a puckering of the blowhole, like a Bronx cheer. And so the low frequency component is really saturated, it's really masked by that. And then when they get further away, that dies out, and just this really low, whatever, there's some sort of resonation chamber within the animal that is carrying those tones right down to the almost to the limit of human hearing.
And what is your specific fascination with the thrum?
Well, part of it, I think, you know, the real story here is why these low frequency signals are being produced by an animal that can be picked up at, some of them we're estimating now, peaked this up to 15 kilometers away. It's like, but the real story is the fact that, as far as we can tell, this has gone undescribed in terms of the scientific literature or even the popular literature. It's like, and these are the signals that, it's not like this is the blue whale and they're transmitting in the below human hearing and you have to upscale it. This is within the human hearing as far as we can tell. And it's great. I love it because it, people who come and have lost their, much of their hearing, they can still detect these. They can almost feel them, you know, because usually it's like in humans, we lose our higher frequency stuff, right? It's almost like this is the last sounds that people, as we leave this mortal coil of nature, that we'll still be able to hear with the unaided ear. And I guess, yeah, the fascination lies in like, how do signals get missed? And being a part of the SETI program, of course, it's been 60 years of extremely dedicated searching for signals or for any signs of life outside of Sweet Gaia, planet Earth. And we know there's abundant water and prebiotic chemicals and lots of energy sources and a gazillion exoplanets, like almost 6,000 and counting. And many of those, you know, a number have been found in the habitable zone and very potentially could create an environment where life has evolved. And, but yet we're not, it's just like, we're just flatlined. We have a great abundance. What we have found in great abundance is evidence of absence. We know where we looked. We know what frequencies we've checked. And so far, it's just us. And it makes you really appreciate the animals that you do have on this earth. Signals get missed. And so keep looking. Don't lose heart. And I guess the story is, it's like, what is it about how we've missed these thrums in these whales that we can apply to the search for life in the universe? And what perceptual filters, or is it a technological one? Is it not having the right tools? Is it, so I think there's lessons to be learned from these thrums, and they're cool to listen to. I mean, they, when they're close at range, it's almost like they can knock you off your stool, right? They're so powerful.
So say we have missed these signals, but then we find a way to find the signals, or we are aware of the signals. Then what?
Hopefully it makes us better stewards of the ocean, better ocean users.
Because we could figure out what the signals mean.
Well, we could, you know, there's always the basic biology and just being fascinated by it. And the more we learn, the more aware we are, and it's like, that's cool. And but there's also, I think, lots of conservation applications, in terms of like being able to, for remote sensing. You know, typically we listened for whales by putting hydrophones underwater and listening to their chatter and their calling and their powerful voices, the songs of the humpbacks and the blue whales and all the species. But here's a chance to do that through the air, which is much more cost effective using microphones. And I mean, I can set the microphone up and just point it out my bedroom window here at the lighthouse, right? And so much easier, much cheaper. And we want to know how many whales are out there, because we want to, first of all, manage our ocean resources so there's enough for all. And we want to know how to set our restoration targets. And we certainly want to avoid them, knowing that if there's local densities of them there's a lot of cruise ships in the sector coming through, and being able to advise shippers is like, hey, we're picking up a higher density of these animals. Maybe set up an alert program. There's very elaborate alert programs that go on for the North Pacific, the North Atlantic right whale, which is down to about 300 individuals. And so there's lots of efforts going into real-time detection of their spatial presence to advise ocean users and shippers and industry and commercial whale watchers of where the animals are, and to give them some space. So being able to count them with the thrums, just being able to monitor them. And as a disentangler, as a NOAA volunteer, as part of the disentanglement network, when we get called out to approach animals that are in distress, and we'll come up and do an initial examination of the animal to see if it's life-threatening. And if it is, then we'll summon more resources and do a full attempt to remove the gear off the animal. And the one thing we don't want is any more casualties. We've already got one. And so being able to approach safely, develop better bedside manners, and the breath of the animal is the one thing that they do give us. You know, whales aren't like, you know, like your dog or your cat that has a tail to wag, and you know, it behaves very differently in terms of the tails for propulsion. They are encased in this envelope of blubber. They become very streamlined evolutionarily, so they don't necessarily have all the facial expressions that you would expect, and they've lost their external ears to perk up, and so they're really, in some ways, they're a lot harder. They have a ton going on inside, but they're a little harder to read than your typical mammals. And so being able to use the breath, and there's certain breath sounds that we've targeted, we realize are associated with an animal that is, it may seem very calm, but when you hear these certain characteristics, one of them we call the pant hoot,
the animal is in a condition where it's might react adversely to an approach, and so we used to learn to step back and, you know, find other ways to maybe approach the animal, assess, and yeah, being able to interact with the animal a little bit more, and not so much doing a disentanglement on, but a disentanglement with the animal, so we can work a little bit more with where their head's at.
I want to pause for a second and share a little behind-the-scenes story. So Fred and I have known each other for years now, and we always run into each other on Chichikov Island in southeast Alaska, where his field office is. And every time I see him, he brings the biggest smile to my face, and I usually a little giggle because of his very Dr. Seuss-like spirit. Same place, different year, and the conversations just keep getting longer, which I am so appreciative of. Now, this summer, we ran into each other again, picking blueberries on this little boardwalk trail, and we just stayed there for hours, talking about whales and politics, AI, the oceans, Alaska life, and everything kind of tangled together. It felt really easy, like, oh yeah, we are kin. And a few months later, I'm at my neighbor's house picking cherries, totally in it, hands full, not stopping, and Fred calls. He's got Joe on speaker, and they're like, you have to come to Five Fingers Lighthouse. And I'm thinking, okay, that sounds amazing, and also kind of insane. Like, tiny island, very, very remote, cliffs, storms, my toddler in tow, boats, tides, timing, no helicopter, just so many logistics. And still, I said yes, because this is honestly why I do this work. I love saying yes to wild invitations, to people who are deeply in relationship with place, to stories that come from the land and water and the more than human world. And I guess that's what I want to name here. For the Wild is shifting. We're becoming a studio now, partnering with people and groups who want help telling their stories. If you're holding a place or a project or a campaign, and you're feeling like this needs to be told, well, that's something we do. We only take a few projects each year, but if you feel called to reach out, to invite us in, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at connect@forthewild.world. Okay, back to the conversation. I can be really resistant to the idea of learning about the earth for categorization or the need to, quote, understand this thing, this other being. I feel like it can be extractive and consumptive, mm-hmm. and actually disconnecting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I usually come to think about these things kind of with a bit of resistance already, and kind of almost like, not that I'm annoyed with you, but this is just the way I kind of feel like prickly about it. Like, well, why are people doing this? Like, why do they want,
yes,
why do they want to know something so they can categorize something so they can explain something to themselves, basically?
Yes.
And it's helping me talk to you because what I'm feeling into is that it's really about relating. And if we can learn to relate in a way that helps us be in relationship, I'm always very hyper aware of the colonizer mind.
I'm sure when you flew down here, you were very grateful that those had gone before you and had studied physics and propulsion, mm-hmm. and jet fuels and filtration systems that,
yeah.
So we all beneficiaries of science, and that's real. Those are real studies and real contributions. But I understand your concerns in that we also, with it, we build weapons and we build non-biodegradable plastics, and our atmosphere is contaminated with, mm-hmm. anthropogenic agents. And so, yes, it can be used for good. And even when it is, can be used for generally, like just making human lives better in excess, it contributes to the imperiled state of our planet.
Mm. And I think it leads to, or it can lead to more human exceptionalism. Like this idea that we are now even more supreme because now we understand whales and we understand this and we understand that. We understand it all. And so this striving to be the ones who are the learned ones, even that can be, to me, it just become unattractive. The dream is that we find a way towards kinship, which is also very hard to have honest kinship with the more than human world because our lifestyles take so much from them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not even looking for some perfect solution or answer or even way of being, but it helps me. And I appreciate having these conversations with you because I knew you could go here with me and we could kind of go into the ugly and we could go into the beauty behind all of this. Like there's so many levels of the story of why and what becomes studied or what is the
sphere of legitimate discussion and controversy, and that in of itself can be incredibly isolating and divisive, and it can leave certain voices out of the conversation. And fortunately there is highly elaborate conservation biology, and you're with a group of peers of like minds, and the goal is to get species so they're not teetering on the brink of extinction, and figure out restoration goals and how do we bring back the black-footed ferret. And it was a lot of monitoring and awareness and hard work that just the other morning a peregrine falcon came in and zoomed and perched right on that rock. And it was like, yes, you're recovered. Same thing with the brown pelicans and the humpback whales and the bald eagles. And there was a lot of science. I mean, mostly it's just being aware of just like staying the human hand is often what, same thing with these whales. It was like, it was stop killing them consumptively. But of course we kill them in many other ways. It's like, if you like your kiwi fruits from New Zealand, but that means that they had to come up here on a large container ship. And at any one time, there's 40,000 of those behemoths plying the oceans and they run over whales. Yeah. And same thing with your foods. Whales get entangled. And so lots of different seafoods can imperil whales and just our just daily living and putting carbon in the atmosphere. It acidifies the ocean and it's harder for the krills to create their carapaces, and so they have to put more energy into maintenance because of the decreasing pH and more acidity of the oceans, and this goes on and on and on, right? And so, and I see your point is that sometimes it's like science, we feel like it's going to solve our excesses by, let's come up with a solution so we can continue on our merry way. I mean, it's hard to take lessons from nature and apply them directly to human, how we should behave and how we should interact, but humpback whales had to do a lot of amazing things with their tool-using behavior of bubbles, and there's large teams. These teams based on sort of food co-op principles. I mean, they figured this stuff out long before we did. Mm. And because these groups, as far as we can tell, these big bubble netting teams, because they appear to be non-relatives, they have a very they're not bound by clan loyalty. And they're up here. There's a really cool seasonal separation of breeding and feeding and breeding and reproduction and sex. There's all kinds of crazy stuff, male display and bravado, or territoriality. And that all goes away. The whales get up here, and that was 6 months ago and 3,000 miles away, is they can actually start to form these coalitions without these disruptive, without jealousy. And, they form these institutions. Some of these whales, as far as we can tell, they've been in these bubble netting teams. I mean, we've never seen them not in a bubble netting team. Yes. And they seem to spend, months, entire summers, decades, perhaps lifetimes, interacting with these other animals. And so there's some really cool deep bonds formations outside of kinship. And we all intuitively, you know, we're highly familial beings. Kinship is blood thicker than water. And, but we form corporations and coalitions and all kinds of institutions are formed in human societies of people who are unrelated.
Right.
And the whales do that too. So I think there's some cool, informative crossover.
Mm-hmm. I like what you're speaking to about awareness. And there's things that you're saying about studying whales and learning about their behaviors that feel calming to me. I personally, and maybe people who are listening, need to get to a place of trust. And I think about the whales a lot in terms of the boat traffic, of course, getting hit, but also just the noise. I mean, isn't it maddening for them?
They undoubtedly spend huge amounts of cognitive resources into just not getting run over by a ship and, or avoiding things and how the sounds, whether, I don't know if maddening's the right word, but you could see how it can gradually impact their ability to the noise to just find each other. Their acoustic theater, you know, to be able to detect and communicate with each other gets much, much smaller when in the noise. And their, it can mask their prey, what they're, where, how they hunt. And, it can, predators, you know, they may not hear the echolocation clicks of a transient pod that's like got designs on the mother's calf, right? And so, yeah, there's lots of, potential, but on the other hand, the humpbacks, they're the loudest. I mean, when they breach and I mean, with their pexlin, I mean, right by their ear, they're pounding the surface with their flippers. They're like giant kettle drums and like they're like on a trampoline with their tail. And some of the studies that were early done and, looking at some of the source levels. I was reading this one paper and, the sound that a humpback can make when it smashes its flukes on the surface, they estimated it's 190 decibels peak to peak. That's higher than a seal bomb, you know, which is one of those commercial devices that actually ward the whale. So it's like, so they have a lot. They have, the fact that the humpbacks have recovered not only here, and the place is lousy with whales now, right? It's wonderful. And it's like, they've recovered 10 of the 14 global population called distinct population segments are considered recovered and have been delisted. And the survival intelligence, the resiliency of these animals is...
All right, friends, that's where we'll leave things for today. Projects like In the Company of Humpbacks don't happen alone. They unfold through long conversations, through time on the water, through shared curiosity, and through a whole constellation of people who care deeply about these whales and the places they call home. This series grew alongside research and storytelling connected to Five Fingers Lighthouse, along with many other generous folks who shared their time, their knowledge, and their boats with us along the way. It's also the first series we're releasing through a new studio model at For the Wild, something we've been quietly building behind the scenes. A space where partners come to us with the stories they want told, and together, we collaborate on bringing these stories into the world. A big thank you as well to the American Cetacean Society, Barnacle Foods, and the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation for supporting the work that made this series possible. And of course, to you. Thanks for wandering these waters with us. And thanks for being a part of this beautiful listening community we're building together. I'll pass things over now to Victoria for a few credits and ways to stay connected.
Thank you for listening to this episode of For the Wild series, In the Company of Humpbacks. For the Wild is produced by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, Julia Jackson, Ori Bittle, and Victoria Pham. This series features music and sound design created by the For the Wild studio. You can also join us on Patreon for access to extended episodes, including the extended version of this very episode, along with uncut conversations and our full archive and publishing library. As For the Wild continues its transformation into the For the Wild studio, we invite you to stay close as we explore new creative offerings, collaborations, and ways of listening together to stay connected. Follow For the Wild on Instagram and subscribe to our newsletter for updates, reflections, and upcoming releases. Thank you for being with us, and as always, thank you for listening.